This coming Thursday is going to be the Feast of Trumpets. And so the feast, final part of God's plan will unfold as we meet on Thursday here on that's the 25th. And we'll meet here for services beginning at 11 a.m. We'll have one service and look forward to the opportunity to gather together to focus upon the significance of the Feast of Trumpets. So we will collect an offering on that day, as we do on all of the God's holy days, and look forward to that very special time that we can get together and keep the Feast of Trumpets. For me, the Feast of Trumpets was my first holy day and in Big Sandy, Texas. So I had heard about the holy days, and Feast of Trumpets in the big building there at Big Sandy was my first feast experience. And I thought, boy, it's awfully hot in this big metal building, which it was at that time of year. But it was the beginning of keeping the holy days, and it's been a wonderful experience over the past 40 years. And when I came into church, I had developed a rather negative attitude about life. So my thinking was not real positive. It was my carnal nature hard at work. And I only had a carnal perspective, and I didn't know much about God or His way of life or the Bible or any of that. And in that period of life, I remember reading through the book of Ecclesiastes, and the book fed my negative outlook, because if you begin to read the book of Ecclesiastes, it is quite negative about life. And the conclusion that I had drawn about life was that life wasn't worth living. It wasn't worth living. There wasn't much to it. But the tone, and as I read through the book of Ecclesiastes, what was being talked about in that book fit right in with my carnal mind. And as I can looked at what it said there at the beginning, how could life be worth living if it's telling us vanity of vanities, all is vanity? So I looked at the book of Ecclesiastes and basically said, well, it agrees with my negative outlook on life. However, as I came into the church and began to look at the book, I gained a different perspective and came to see that I did not have the discernment to see the true meaning. So God opened my mind to see that yes, there's a negative element to it, but it depends on how you look at it and where is that negative element coming from. So I came to better understand the book and to see its essential meaning for me and all of us as Christians. And through considering the Ecclesiastes chapter 1, which is all we're going to look at today, we're going to seek to understand some fundamentals about life, some fundamentals about our approach to life, and the fundamental points that have much to do with our approach to life in general and also have an impact on how we will keep the upcoming feast. And my title is All is Vanity or Is It? All is Vanity or Is It? As you look at Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and if you would turn there, we'll just look at the first few verses. Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Ecclesiastes has some wonderful truths in it, but you've got to wade into it and examine it and think about it and try to understand the approach that's being used here. It begins in chapter 1, verse 1. It says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem." So if you look at what it says there, there are the words that were written down by a particular individual. He's identified by the fact that he is a son of David and he is king in Jerusalem. And there was only one son of David who was ever king in Jerusalem, and that man was Solomon. So Solomon, this is a book that Solomon wrote. We don't know exactly what stage of life that he wrote in. Was it at the end of his life? That seems most probable, but we don't know that for sure. But the conclusions that he comes to are quite important for us as God's people. He begins by saying, "Vanity of vanity," says the preacher. "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." And then he says, "What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun?" What profit do we have from all the labor which we undertake under the sun? So as you look at that, that's not exactly an approach that's bursting with joy and it's very positive. It's looking at life in a rather negative way. And but we have to realize here that Ecclesiastes is a part of God's Word. So God has included this in the Scriptures for a purpose. But is it true that life is nothing but meaningless trouble? Is life nothing but something without purpose or value? Does our Creator intend life to be an unremitting stream? It's just an endless stream of frustrations broken only by death. You know, there are people that have that perspective. You know, they look at life in a rather, you know, there's always a dark cloud, and no matter how bright and sunny the day is, they can find a dark cloud out there, and that's their overall perspective, that life is rather negative. Some people who've looked at the book look at Ecclesiastes and say it's rather a gritty book. And they say this because the book doesn't pull any punches about life. It tells us straight up that life is difficult. Life is difficult. The book doesn't address minor issues, but it looks at major events and major issues that can be challenges for us as we go through life. We can either be blessed or we can be cursed as we go through these challenges. They can lead to blessing or cursing. They fill and change the course of one's life. And they are the kind of happenings that occur in a life and we step back from them and we say, where is God in what I'm going through? And probably all of us have had that experience with some of the things that we faced in life. It's been rather difficult. It's been rather challenging. And we wonder, where is God in what I'm going through? As you look at the book of Ecclesiastes, you can almost look at it and the way that it describes being a human being, as it describes us as being caught in a maze. You know, we're just kind of like in this maze and we're like rats running around in that maze. And that's somewhat to some degree the way that it pictures our lives. We're forced to make choices that either opens the way for us or closes the way toward the goal of getting out of that maze. And our choices are ours to make. And they can be either choices that yield growth and profit in living, or they can block us and cause frustration. The choices we make are most important, and they determine whether we're going to stay in that maze or not. For a Christian, this means that a reality of life is that everything matters. Have you ever stopped and thought about that? Everything matters. I'd never heard that statement until we were watching a particular TV show, and the guy on the show, his dad said, everything matters. So I thought, well, does it? Does everything matter? You know, so if I decide that I want to paint my room green as opposed to blue, does that matter? Probably not very much. You know, that's a minor decision that we have to make, and there are a lot more momentous decisions than that. But what we have to realize is that every event and choice does not matter to the same extent, but they all, added up all together, they do matter to some degree. Solomon's experience reminds us that our calling is too precious to waste on meaningless vanity. You know, we can waste a lot of time on different things that we might do. And one of Solomon's conclusions is, don't do that. There are momentous things, and don't waste your time on things that don't really produce any fruit. God gives us the wisdom in Ecclesiastes to help us grasp what the major paths and choices must be so that life will have meaning. And he's going to elaborate for us as he goes through the book, make these choices and your life will have meaning. Make these other choices and your life is going to have less meaning. And the major teaching of Ecclesiastes is that life offers lots of choices. But when you really get down to it, there are only two major choices. Only two major choices. And that is the choice that moves toward God and the choice that is ours, that is based upon us being men. We only have two choices. So which choices would be wiser as you think about life, to move toward God or to make our own choices and do what we want to do. If life is to be profitable, then God and His way must not just be an occasional thought. Once in a while we think about God. Most of the time we're doing whatever we feel is right. That's not a good choice. God's way must be chosen deliberately. And we have to begin to make that choice in every choice that we make and everything that we face. We have to say, what would God want me to do? What would be to His glory? What would be to His honor? And that's a way of thinking that we all have to arrive at, and it's not natural to the carnal mind. We have to make deliberate choices about which path we will follow. And the reason that we do that is because our choices matter. Our choices matter. And as we choose to go God's way, it's going to help us come to a positive conclusion in our life. If God's not deliberately chosen, our lives may be filled with lots of activity, but there may not be much to show for it. There may not be much to show for it. So Ecclesiastes is not truly about the meaninglessness of life. It's about the meaninglessness of the life apart from God. See, apart from God, life is meaningless. And Solomon wrote, as far as living a life apart from God, the way he designated that was living life entirely under the sun. And we'll focus on those three words in a few minutes here. So, as you look at people, there are a lot of people that start out and they're full of life and vibrance and energy and drive, and they all have all sorts of hopes and dreams of things that they're going to accomplish. But then look at them at 65, look at them at 75, look at them at 80, and they don't have the same drive, the same purpose, that sparkle in their eye many times that they had when they were young. And it's not just because they've gotten old. It's because they've lived their lives entirely under the sun, apart from God. And when they look at their lives and what they've done, they begin to say, you know what? It doesn't add up to much. They may have accumulated all sorts of wealth and all sorts of wonderful things in their lives, but you know what? You're not taking any of it with you. In fact, you may have worked diligently to acquire the things that you have. And when you're dead, your reputation is gone. It may live on for a little while, but not for very long. And somebody else may get all of the things that you accumulated. And as Ecclesiastes tells us, he may be a fool. Fools do end up with the good things once in a while. You know, like it says in the book of, you know, like one person said, you know, even a blind squirrel gets a nut once in a while. So fools do accumulate some of those things, not because they deserve them, but because that's just the way life works out. And as the book of Ecclesiastes tells us, that seems unfair. And in a sense, it is. So let's think about the term vanity of vanities. That's what it says at the beginning of Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. So the book starts abruptly. It explains who wrote it. And then it says this phrase, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And as you go through the first three verses there, you come across that term, vanity of vanities. And you also come across a couple of other words that are significant. One of them is profit. So vanity is one of the words that's of great significance, and it's mentioned quite often in the book of Ecclesiastes, as we will see. The second word that's very important is profit. And the third words that are important are the ones that I've mentioned here, which is under the sun. Those are three terms that are used in the book that are quite significant to them. And we're going to focus on those three terms because they tell us a lot about the points that the writer of the book is making. The first one we'll look at here briefly is vanity. It's a metaphor. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. As I said, it's used 33 times in the book, and it suggests breath. Something like a vapor. you know, on a cold day, as you breathe out, you have water vapor that comes out. But how long does it last? It comes out and then it's gone. It's something that doesn't last. And that's what I suggest, that it's something that is goes away very fast. You know, you have smoke from fire. It doesn't last very long. And we most assuredly can't grasp it or hold on to it. You know, as you breathe out on a cold day and all that, the steam comes out. Can you grasp it? Can you hold it? You can't. It's something that's there and gone, goes away very quickly. So vanity portrays life as insubstantial, as rather flimsy and passing. It's fleeting. It goes away very quickly. One of the most vivid explanations of vanity suggests, as you have a bubble, a soap bubble, and, you know, as you pop that soap bubble, it'll leave a little bit of scum. But of what value is what's left behind from that bubble? There's no value to it. It's just something you have to clean up with whatever product you use to clean your bathroom. It's not of any value at all. The NIV translates Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 2. It translates vanity of vanity, vanity, all is vanity. But it translated as meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. And that's a pretty negative point of view. The Message Bible renders it smoke, nothing but smoke. There is nothing to anything. It's all smoke. It's all smoke. It just goes away very quickly. It doesn't last. And while it makes for a provocative opening, vanity is not useless to God's purpose. You know, God didn't just start the Bible, this book, in this particular way. He has a purpose behind it. Because when you look at it and somebody tells you life has no meaning, that's a pretty strong statement. And that's how the book begins, because God is trying to get our attention. Let's go back to, and as I said, this idea of vanity plays a very important part in our lives, as we'll see. Let's go to Romans chapter 8. And the Apostle Paul addresses this subject in Romans chapter 8, beginning in verse 18. Romans chapter 8, beginning in verse 18. Paul here says, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us." So remember, I said life is hard. And living life, you're going to suffer. That's just the way life is. You may not suffer all the time. You may suffer more than some people. You may suffer less than some people. But you're going to suffer. That's just how it is. But as you think about the bigger things that God is working out, those sufferings, those things that are part of this world, aren't even to be compared with what God is ultimately working out for us, what is pictured by the Feast of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement and the Feast of Tabernacles and the Last Great Day. In comparison, the troubles and trials we face in this life are insignificant, he tells us. But the sufferings are part of life. They are part of life. He goes on to say, "For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God." The creation itself seems to be groaning. It's not physical, but he's using personification here to give you the idea of what our world, our physical world, goes through. And it groans under sin and groans under all of the sufferings and difficulties that exist. And it, in essence, looks forward to the time when God's great plan will be worked out and the sons of God will be revealed. Verse 20, it says, "For the creation was subjected to futility." In the King James Version, the word there is vanity. The creation was subjected to futility or vanity, not willingly. You know, that's not what it desired, not what it wanted in a sense, but because of him who subjected it in hope. God's the one who subjected the creation to vanity, to futility. And all of us, we're here on the earth and we're going to experience that too. And God made this a part of the world in which we live. Now, is that the way that God ordained it from the very beginning? So when God created the heavens and the earth, on that day God said, man is going to be subject to futility. When did the vanity and the futility come on the scene? When was it introduced? Well, it appears that it was introduced in Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3 tells us of the sin of Adam and Eve. It tells of their expulsion from the garden, and it tells us of certain curses that were pronounced upon them by God. And it seems apparent from where God enumerates the curses following the sins of the first man and woman, that he not only pronounced man's subjection to a measure of vanity, but that was the time or the point in time in which it was activated. So God deliberately subjected the creation to futility or vanity as a result of sin. And God subjected mankind to that because he wants them to learn certain lessons. He wanted life to be difficult in order that they would learn certain lessons that they would not learn otherwise. Because God's goal is for mankind to grow to be like him, to have his character. And only by life being hard and difficult at times can man learn those lessons. So we have to recognize that this is the way the world is, and we have to deal with it. We have to recognize it and deal with it. So despite Solomon's negativity here at the beginning of the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon, as he wrote the book, did not ever lose sight of God. And we can note that because at the end of the book, you know, Solomon tells us what? What's the summary of everything we've discussed here? To seek God and his commandments. That's what he concludes the book with. So that he had that overriding purpose as he goes through all of this. That's the conclusion of everything. So we go through the vanity, we go through the futility, we go through all of these things, and we learn as we go through this process that the basic bottom line is to seek God and his commandments. That's what life is all about. That's the choice we want to make. So that's something that is important to remember, that that's the conclusion that Solomon comes to at the end of everything. As you go back, let's go back to Romans 8 and just look at verse 18. Again, it talks about the sufferings, and Paul considering the sufferings that we go through, that this world and nature impose on us, he concludes that they're insignificant. They're insignificant to what lies ahead if we overcome the vanities that we have to face in life. And in verse 19, as I said, he personifies the creation as burdened and groaning, right along with us because of the futility imposed on it. And he says the creation looks forward to its release from what the Creator subjected it to. And that time of release will come. The time of release will come as we are resurrected and we are spirit beings in God's soon coming kingdom. So in conclusion, God purposefully subjected the creation to vanity or futility. So that's a reality that we have to face. That's the way the world is. We can't unmake the world. It is the way it is. And vanity serves our overall good in preparing us for God's kingdom. By seeing what really matters and what doesn't matter, it helps us to prepare for God's kingdom. And vanity is a challenging obstacle. Have you ever been frustrated in life? Have you ever stopped and thought that I've not accomplished much in my life? My life isn't really worth much? Sometimes we reflect on these things. We become philosophical. Since I'm doing this sermon today, I was thinking about, I've got all these different physical breakdowns. You know, my mouth is basically bionic at this point with all the different things they've done, bridges, crowns, and every other thing to keep it going versus false teeth. And then you've got my eyes are fading, I can't hear, and, you know, my joints hurt. We've got all these things. So I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that's how life is. And sometimes you sit there and you look at I'm fading. And as you look at the book of Ecclesiastes, it says, remember God, your creator, in the time of your youth. Don't wait till the time when you can't see. Don't wait to the time when you can't chew anything. Don't wait to the time when you can't hear the birds sing. You're in the latter stages of life. Remember God well before then. That's wisdom. So the sufferings that vanity imposes help us to see things clearly, to see them from God's perspective, and to see that there are bigger things that we need to occupy ourselves with. The second question that comes up is based upon the second word, and that word is prophet. Prophet. It's only used 6 times in the book of Ecclesiastes, but it's a part of the beginning of the book. It's placed at the beginning in order to add weight to the points that Solomon is going to make. It's used as if Solomon is asking these questions. In light of the fact that so much of life is vanity, is life really worth living? If everything's vanity, is life worth living? Is it worth going through life's vanity-packed challenges? And if we go through all of this, what do we gain from it? What's the profit? What profit do we have from all of these things we go through? As we look at life, it requires us to expend a great deal of time, energy, and stress. Don't we go through stress in life? We stress over various things. And all of these things, time and energy and stress, are all companions of vanity. They're all companions of the pains of vanity. We have to go through those things. There's no way around it. On the surface, life appears to be just running in circles. How many people call it a rat race? I'm in the maze. How many of us have concluded that life's a rat race? And, you know, as you think about it, because, you know, as we're going to see here, one of the things that Solomon brings out about life, it's cyclical. It's cyclical. Have you ever thought about the rat race? I get up at whatever time in the morning. I have breakfast. I get in the car. I fight the traffic to go to work. I work all day. I come home. I'm tired. I watch a little TV or do whatever other things I have to do. Go to bed, and I do it again. And I do that on Monday, and I do it on Tuesday, and I do it on Wednesday, and I do it on Thursday, and I do it on Friday. And then I get up on Monday and I do it again. And I do it for 1 year and 2 years and 25 years and 30 years. And maybe when I get through the 30-year cycle, they give me this nifty watch. You know, the Velcro Timex, you know, and say thanks, you know, and I move on. And when you get done with it, what do you have to show for it? I made a lot of bolts, or I drilled a lot of holes, or I repaired a lot of toilets, whatever it may be. What's the outcome of all of that? What's the lasting outcome? So you can look at it that way, and it seems like there's no profit to any of this. What are we doing? And as you think about life, you think about time. You know, time has gone on for, you know, it appears billions of years. And here I am going to live my 70 in the perspective of time, it's pretty small. In the perspective of the human population, you've got 7 billion people or so living now. You're just one person out of that 7 billion. And if you think about the span of man's existence, you're just one person over those 6,000 years. You are puny. You're of little significance. And think about the earth's natural cycles. You come, you go. They went through their process when you were alive, and they're going to go through the process when you're dead. And you can begin to think in those terms and say, you know, What profit is there in all of this? What profit is there? Solomon's question regarding profit is asked to stimulate our thinking. He wants us to think, what profit is there in all of this? Is there a profit? He wants us to stop and think. And until I came into the church, I didn't do much thinking about these things. But for some reason, when I was about 20 or 21, these thoughts that there has to be some bigger purpose came into my mind. Because I could see that all of this is futility. We are like rats in a maze, and we keep doing the same foolish things over and over and over again. And we never get off that cycle. You know, it looks like after you slaughtered 54 million people during World War II, you'd say, you know, we've had enough of this. Maybe we should stop. But we're building up to more conflagration instead of learning our lessons. We just never seem to learn. So the thing is, the only thing that makes it profitable is to know God and to have a relationship with God. He is the factor that makes all the difference. He's the one that makes it profitable. And as God comes into the picture, life becomes profitable. It becomes enjoyable. It can actually be abundant, and it can actually lead to everlasting life. And you know, as you receive everlasting life, it's not going to be filled with futility. It's going to be filled with purpose and hope. And the things that God has planned for us have to be amazing. We're not just going to be sitting on our duffs up in heaven or wherever we're sitting. That's not how God is. And we won't be either. The third term that's important here is under the sun. And it's a little bit mysterious. What does that mean? What does it mean, under the sun? And as you think about being under the sun, it's a term that accounts for much of why Ecclesiastes seems so pessimistic when we first read it. Why does the author use this figure of speech? Well, the phrase gives us the perspective from which Solomon and the overwhelming majority of human beings look at life. Solomon, as he begins the book, is looking at life under the sun. And that's how most people look at life. Maybe not at the beginning, but many times at the end of their lives. And they see that life under the sun is meaningless. It is pointless. And because, you know, under the sun is where most of us live. So to see things under the sun is to look at life's events from a carnal perspective, from a perspective that is apart from God. And under the sun is to think and to act from an earthly point of view, to look at things carnally. And Solomon is leaving God out of the picture. And for a time, as the book unfolds, he wants to make a point. If I look at life just under the sun, these are the common conclusions that men come to. His purpose at this point is to get us to think. To get us to think and to begin to fear that vanity is all there is to life. And all too often in the crush of everyday events, we forget to remember God and His purpose. We're busy. We don't have time for God. I don't have the time to think about God as I'm making decisions. I've just got to make the decision. And we do. And we just go on with life. And the point of the book here is you're missing something very significant if you live life that way. And it's very easy for us, as we don't think of God in our everyday decisions and make a deliberate choice to think of God in our decisions, then it's very easy to live carnally. To just go about your business and not think about God at all. We have to change our thinking process to where God has to be first and foremost. Now, as I said, Ecclesiastes is not just about meaningless. It also opens us to the possibility of not just living life under the sun, but to live life above the sun, in what's beyond the sun. Not just in a confined way, but to begin to see beyond that perspective. That's what God wants us to see. He wants us to see that God has a great plan, and He has great desires for all of us. And he wants us to come to the point to see that all of this vanity is a waste of time and it's something that's pointless. To become so disgusted with it that we're going to say, I want what's beyond the sun. I want what God offers to me. So, as Solomon goes through this, we find that he's not all that pessimistic about life in which God is considered. The truth is that he's teaching why everything matters. That as God's children need to be aware of making right choices or life will be meaningless. For instance, I used to spend a lot of time with sports. I used to be excited about sports. There are various things that I was excited about. Sports was one of them. And there's come a point in my life where it's interesting to watch a football game or whatever it may be, but I'm not like I was at 16. On New Year's Day, all the games are going to be played. I'm excited because I'm going to watch all the games. And I want one team to win over the other. I picked my teams and I'm excited and I'm, oh man, they blew it and you're all agitated about it. But there came a point where it doesn't really matter anymore. I know that I was slightly frustrated when the Texas Rangers lost the World Series. They could have won on two pitches. All they needed was to make one pitch. And that, I think, is an illustration of vanity. One pitch was all it took. They couldn't make the pitch and they lost. And my countenance fell. But I also knew that the sun would rise the next day and life would go on. But you know, when you're involved in this, and sports is important, whatever it may be, it's really significant in your life and you have to come to see, you know what? In the greater scheme of things, this doesn't matter. You know? I used to love music. I used to love music and listen to a lot of music. Every time you got in the car, boom, the radio's on and you're listening to music. And, you know, in the old days when you used to be able to punch in, you know, put in different stations, you hit the button. So I'd be hitting the button and moving all over. I hate that song, so I'm going over to this. And some of you who were teenagers back in the day, you remember that. You know, so anyway, we tuned in our music right away. And music was important. And it was very motivating. It was very, you know, music expresses emotion. And it can be uplifting. It can be depressing. It can support all sorts of moods. And I like music, but it doesn't matter so much anymore. And a lot of things don't matter so much anymore. And it's not that there aren't significant things in life, but as you grow and you begin to see what's really significant, those things don't matter anymore. They don't matter. So you begin to say there are more significant things. It's not that I don't watch a football game. It's not that I don't listen to music. It's not any of that, but it doesn't occupy the same status in my life. And if I don't listen to it, life goes on. There are bigger things. There are better things that God is wanting us to see. You know, so we have to make our choices and we want to do things that are profitable. So we have to begin to ask ourselves, what is profitable? And whatever you're doing, whatever you're thinking about, you've got to say, is this profitable? Does it mean that we never have any recreation or any of that? No, that's not what it means. But you have to make priorities and to enjoy life or run or whatever you happen to do, enjoy it. But keep God where he needs to be. Solomon, following his opening declarations, then launches into a series of illustrations about the earth's cycles. And he applies them as evidence of the kind of environment in which we live. We may not think about this a lot, but Solomon says, I want you guys to think about this because this is important, something you need to think about. Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 1 once again. And let's look at beginning in verse 4. Ecclesiastes chapter 1 verse 4. One generation passes away, and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. One generation comes, one generation passes away, but the earth is still there. Still there, didn't change. He goes on to say in verse 5, but the sun also rises, and the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it rose. So the sun rises, it sets. It rises, it sets. And this cycle keeps going. It keeps going. Regardless of what we do, it's going to keep going. It says in verse 6, the wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. So there's this circuit. The wind blows and it goes to the north, turns to the south, and comes back to the north again. And it keeps coming over and over again. It says in verse 7, all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. So you've got a cycle, the hydrologic cycle. So you've got the rain falls, it falls into the river. The river runs into the sea. There's evaporation, and it eventually comes back over the land and drops again. And this cycle keeps on going, one after another. It says, all things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. So you've got all these things that are going on, and it sets a tone for us to realize that all of these things are cyclical. And it presents a picture that is somewhat monotonous. It goes on and on and on. And, you know, think about mankind. You know, a new generation comes every 20 to 25 years. They're born into the world. And the new generation comes along and they give you the impression they're all vibrant and full of life. And they give you the idea that something is actually happening. But nothing is really happening except the older generation is dying off. And it seems in a seemingly endless procession of people comes and goes. And nothing changes, really. What's changed? The translator of the Latin Vulgate version of the Bible, his name was Jerome, wrote, "What is more vain than this vanity, that the earth, which was made for humans, stays? But humans themselves, the lords of the earth, suddenly dissolve into dust." They dissolve into dust. We just go back to dust, and the earth keeps rotating, and everything continues as it was. The sun comes up, and the sun goes down. The winds constantly move. The weather, but nothing changes. The cycle goes on and on. And these cycles produce no real change in the quality of human life. There's a lot of motion on the earth's surface, but no promotion of a truly profitable life for mankind. You know, everybody's all worried about ISIS or ISIL, whatever you want to call it. Lots of talking. What are we going to do? And they'll probably come up with some plan. But what's going to change? If it's not ISIL, it's going to be somebody else. And on it goes. Let's go to verse 8. It says here, all things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. Do you ever want to see new things? We all do, don't we? We all like it. God created us that way. Something new and different. Do we want to hear new things? I mean, I remember back when I first started listening to music. And I remember when the Four Tops came out with Sugar Pie Honey Bunch. That song was so good. And I had had a record player. Some of you may not know what a record player is. You'll have to look on the internet in order to understand what that was. They were vinyl. And this was a 45. Vinyl, you put it on the record player and it plays. And I remember listening to that song over and over again because it was just so upbeat and positive. But, you know, it's kind of lost its luster. So I want new things to listen to. And that's how we tend to be as human beings. We're never satisfied. We've got to listen to something new. We've got to listen to something different because that's the way we are as human beings. And we never are satisfied. You know, when you got that brand new bike, did that bike ever get old? Did you want a new bike? Or maybe, I don't want a bike, I want a motorcycle. Or, you know, you want to move up to the better, the bigger and better. And that's how we are as human beings. It goes on to say here in verse 9, that which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. So he's telling, and then in verse 11, there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come, but those who will come after. By those who will come after, you know, you're not going to be remembered, I'm not going to be either. So none of this, as you look at these verses, means that mankind is not moving about. Earth is witness to a great deal of activity, but it is essentially purposeless. And there's a great deal of sound and fury, but with no advancement in quality of life or purposeful direction. And Solomon's word pictures show mankind striving to see and hear new things, but the reality is more repetition of the same old things. He pictures mankind as little more than a milling mass, and man tends to be quite forgetful. Oh, this is brand new. Is it really? You know, you look at the people, a group of people that Paul confronted in the city of Athens. And the people in Athens were always looking to hear something new. They were constantly looking for new to titillate their intellects. And Paul pointed them, you know, you guys are wasting your time. He didn't tell them that. But he said, let me reveal to you what is really significant. They didn't get it, but he sought to help them to understand it. Understanding this desire for novelty is something that a lot of people in our world called entrepreneurs realize. You know, if I can find something new and different, I'm going to make a lot of money. So there must be things that are new. They find things that are new, things that are better, something, things that are bigger, redesigned, more serviceable, more attractive, faster, safer, more economical, whatever it may be. And they sell them to us. For instance, the entertainment industry is constantly repackaging the same stories. For instance, when I was a little kid, you had cowboys and you had the good guys and the bad guys, the white hats and the black hats. Well, the updated version, one updated version of the good guys and the bad guys is Star Wars. Let's just put the cowboys in outer space. Same thing. Bad guy, Darth Vader and all of his henchmen, and the good guys, Luke Skywalker and the rest of the gang. All right? Good guys, bad guys. Same story, just told in a different context. But it's no different. And that's the way it is with most stories. You know, how many of you have watched TV? I've watched TV for a long time. And a lot of it's pretty boring because it's a lot of the same stories. It's not original anymore. And that's how it is. That's how it is for us as human beings. So Solomon doesn't mean, as he looks at all of this, that there are no new technologies or inventions. There are. And by saying there's nothing new under the sun, he's attempting to stimulate us to consider that what might effectively improve the quality of life. So is that new iPad really going to improve your life? If you drink Coke Zero as opposed to regular Coke, is that going to make your life better? You betcha. But anyway, I mean, I don't think so. You know, one tastes better than the other, but it's probably not going to add that zing to your life that you're looking for. The bulk of mankind lives by the same basic patterns that Adam and Eve lived by. It hasn't changed. And Solomon is searching for a hopeful way of life, one that will fill a person with joy and his mind with pure, godly inspiration and character. He goes on to say in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 8, he says in regard to labor, it says, all these things are wearying. And they tend to be as we look at life. What Solomon has shown to this point is not the full story. In fact, he's just begun. Using generalities, he's exposed only the broad extent of the problem that we face as human beings. And he's going to fill in more information as you go through the book. So I would say, go through the book. And try to see what the points that Solomon is making. But keep in mind, he's talking about under the sun at times, and he's wanting us to look above the sun, to where God is, to really understand life. So he's taking, you know, he's showing us a different perspective, an important perspective. So let's go down to verse 12. of the book, Ecclesiastes 1, verse 12. It says, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I was king, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. So I'm seeking to look at things and apply wisdom to it, apply reason to it, in order that I can understand it. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. So that's my job and your job. Our job is to look at life and with God's help come to the proper perspective. What counts? What is vain? What is profitable? What is under the sun? What is above the sun? To seek God's wisdom in order to see that. But if we just operate on the physical plane, we just think in human terms and apply reason, we're never going to get it. We're never going to get it. In verse 14, he says, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. You know, these things, they don't change. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is grasping for wind. For in much wisdom is much grief. In much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So if you apply your reason and you look at everything and you figure everything out, you eventually hit a wall. With reason, you can never rise above the sun. You can't. You're stuck under the sun. You're stuck in vanity. And you come to the conclusion as you go through that process that there is nothing profitable. It's not profitable. But then you don't know where to go. Once you reach that point, you don't have anywhere to go. And that's the challenge. At least you've come to that point. There's got to be more. There's got to be something else. But unfortunately, there isn't. The book's first 11 verses don't provide much in the way of hope for one's life. But, Solomon at that point is not ready to elaborate more on what the meaning of life. He's looking for some explanations. And, you know, as human beings, we are different from animals. You know, animals don't stop and think, I'm a dog, therefore I am, or I am, therefore I'm a dog, or whatever it is. They don't think about that. You know, there are no animals that are thinking, despite the Far Side cartoons. They're not deep in thought. All right? So they're not wondering why I exist and what's God's greater purpose for me. Only man has that ability. Animals can't think in those terms. And interestingly, as you look at the book, it says the first mention of God is in verse 13. It's in verse 13. And he says that God has given to the sons of men to go through this process of analyzing things and thinking about the meaning of life. And as you look at verse 15, it says, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. And what he's telling us there is, this is a blunt fact of life. The fact that we have to deal with. We can't make the crooked straight. We can't number what is lacking. And when Solomon states, what is crooked cannot be made straight, he's referring not to anything material, you know, that's crooked and we can straighten it out, but rather to the circumstances and events of life. An obvious example is that the past cannot be changed. How do you change the past? You can remember it. But can you change it? I can't change it, and you can't change it. We can't change the past. That's one of the challenges that we faced. We can't change it. And, you know, we may resolve an injustice or an apology may be given, but many lasting effects of what took place in the past remain, don't they? The Living Bible paraphrases this verse where it talks about that which is crooked. It says, what is wrong cannot be righted. It is water over the dam, and there is no use thinking of what might have been. We have to remember, though, that God has the power to straighten out what is twisted or crooked to supply what is lacking. He can't change the past, but he can help us deal with it and to straighten it out. But that's something that God can do, and only God can do. He can change the way that the past affects us, which is most encouraging to all of us who believe. You know, we can be forgiven. We can forgive others. And we can move forward in a positive way. One of the things that we have to realize is we don't see much. We don't understand very clearly, and we can't see perfectly clearly. As 1 Corinthians 13, verse 13 says, we see dimly. We can't see perfectly. We can't see it all. But an overriding principle that has to guide us is this. Let's go to Romans 8, verse 28. Keep your finger in Ecclesiastes because we'll come back there. But Romans 8, verse 28, it's interesting. This verse is in the same chapter that talks about life being filled with futility, and that's the way God made it. So life is vain, life is filled with futility, and knowing that, Paul makes this statement in verse 28, and it is one of my favorite verses. It says in verse 28, and we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to His purpose. So life may be vain. It may seem profitless at times. It may be hard. It may be difficult. But it says we have to keep the perspective that God is involved and all of it is going to work out for our ultimate good. All things work together for good to those who are called according to His purpose. And you know, we all face situations where life is subpar. It's very hard. But we have to realize something greater is being worked out. And there are things that we can learn from it. And we must seek God's help in dealing with it and putting it all in order. You know, and we may never figure out, you know, I know a member of the church whose child was born with spina bifida. And the child has had one problem after another. One operation after another. Why is that fair? That child's had to go through all sorts of trauma at the hospital and the parents to agonize with the child. Why is that fair? That's part of the futility of the world. And you may never figure out why God allowed you to go through that. But you have to trust, God is allowing me to go through this, and my job is to deal with it in an above the sun perspective and approach. And that's hard to do, but that's what God wants us to learn to do. And it's part of helping us to prepare for His kingdom. So looking at life through the eyes of faith, we can know that about life to some degree. But at this point in Ecclesiastes, Solomon is warning us that it contains a great deal of inequity. It contains a great deal of disappointment and discouragement. It contains a great deal of evil. It contains a great deal of apparent injustice. It contains a great deal of pain. Nations enter into war without permission. Governments and their systems are corrupt. The courts are unfair and corrupt. Businessmen lie and steal. All clearly caused by the minds and the hands of men, people who live under the sun. And there is so much of this, he says, it's beyond count. We can't count all of this. And God could easily stop these events. Could God stop all of this? Yes, He could. But He hasn't. There will come a point where He says, enough. But we've not reached that point yet. That time is coming. Is it any wonder that Paul said the following in Galatians chapter 1? Let's go to Galatians chapter 1. Galatians chapter 1, it says, who gave Himself, that's speaking of Jesus Christ, for our sins, that He might deliver us from this present evil age. It is through Christ that we can be delivered from this present evil age according to the will of our God and Father. It is God's will that we would be delivered from this evil age. And God at least gives us the deliverance where we can see the bigger picture. We can see the bigger picture that there's something great and wonderful working out here. One of the unwritten questions in Ecclesiastes is, why doesn't God stop all of these evil things? And God's not going to. God's not going to at this time, but we can know that eventually it's going to be worked out. That's one of the wonderful things about the upcoming holy days, to realize that these things are going to work out. The conclusion to Ecclesiastes should prove to us that wisdom and experience will not solve every problem in life. It doesn't matter how smart you are. Being smart isn't going to solve it. You need God and His wisdom to solve it. We must understand and live with the reality that God is not obligated to explain our problems to us. Just look at Job. Did God explain everything to him? He never knew. Job is, as we look at Job, Job is like, you know, we're looking down on Job. And we have a perspective when we look at Job that Job never had. He didn't see it the way we see it. He never knew. All he had to do was come to trust God and learn those lessons that God wanted him to learn. And he did learn them. And God blessed him. And God is going to raise him up at the last day. We are the sinners who chose, as Adam and Eve did, to accept Satan's deceitful offer. That if they would listen to him and eat the fruit, their eyes would be opened. And their eyes were opened. And our eyes are opened. But even though they're open, we can't see. Not clearly until God comes into the picture. And if we follow their path, can we expect different results? Nope, going to be the same results. That monotonous, in the maze situation. So life now is a tremendous blessing to all of us because God has opened our minds to His truth. We must accept the reality, though, that we must live by faith in God's promises, and that's what we do as we go up to the feast days. We might ask ourselves, in light of Ecclesiastes 1, will this feast be a profitable experience? Will it be profitable? Or will it be vain? At the feast, will we live under the sun, or will we live above the sun? What will it be? I know that in a number of feasts early on, I lived under the sun. I remember the feast where we bought all sorts of alcohol and we were going to try all sorts of drinks. We didn't get drunk. I remember some of the alcohol was left after the feast and I said, well, I'm going to make a rusty nail. And so my wife tasted it and she said, well, I think I'm going to get blood poisoning from that particular drink. But we were living, you know, you didn't have the perspective. Now, we don't care about the booze. That's not important. That's not why we go to the feast. Do we enjoy a drink? Yes. But it's not important. And it shouldn't be. What is important? It's what's there above the sun as we seek God. So we go to the feast. We make choices. We make choices in how we will keep the feast. Will we go there to drink in of the knowledge that is given to us? Will we conduct ourselves in a way that is conducive to our getting the most out of services? That's what we want to do. It's not just a vacation. It should be enjoyable, but it's not just a vacation. There's something bigger that we need to see. So God in His mercy has miraculously broken into our lives to prepare us for His kingdom. And our challenge is to meet those challenges that this life of futility presents us. We must cease living our lives running in circles. We can choose how we live. And we must head straight for the kingdom of God. That's what life is all about. That's the profitable life lived above the sun. So please have a good week. We'll see you on Thursday for the Feast of Trumpets and focus upon that aspect of God's great plan as the final aspect of the holy days begin. And please have the remainder of a most wonderful Sabbath day.